Hey, it's Christine from Storyworthy. Today on the show, screenwriter Stephanie Mikus talks about her childhood and growing up with an illness.
Sometimes when it was too much, I'd pour my medicine down the bathroom drain. Sometimes when I was supposed to be fasting, I'd open the fridge door, slam a slice or two of leftover Mama Celeste pizza, wipe my face, and emerge with just that icy glass of water to which I was actually entitled. I would fire doctors. Not like ask my mom if they could never come back quietly later, but literally create performative theater where I bitingly uttered the phrase, "You're fired," which would be ruined by Donald Trump just a few years later.
Today on the show, screenwriter Stephanie Mikus talks about growing up with a serious illness and how she overcame it. Stay close.
Hey, it's Stephanie Mikus, and you're listening to Storyworthy.
Welcome to Storyworthy. My name is Christine Blackburn, and I'm coming to you from Los Angeles, California. Whether you're a longtime fan of the show or a new listener, welcome to Storyworthy. We're going now over 8 years. You realize that, Stephanie?
I didn't, but wow.
Yeah, because in podcasting years, I'm like 100.
I did a year max. I did 40 episodes, and I tapped out of the
40
business.
40 episodes is a lot.
Yeah, 42 maybe, but it was a lot.
Do you know, recently I went to a podcast convention in Philadelphia called Podcast Movement, and they said that 90% of podcasts that start don't get past 3 episodes.
What? Wow.
So 40 is amazing.
I mean, I had the pressure of like a network and like a whole thing behind me. But yeah, 3 episodes. I mean, that makes sense. Most people are just like talking to
themselves. Well, they don't think it out. They just, they think about one episode and they don't think about the longevity of, you know, really forethought. They don't think of the forethought of how
congrats
much.
Congrats on 8 years.
Yeah, man, it's all good. Thank you so much. I hope you guys enjoyed the show last week with celebrity trainer Vinny Tortuich. Did you ever hear of Vinny Tortuich?
I haven't, but Stephanie? I love celebrity trainers.
Yeah, well, that was the first one I ever met, and I felt like a weakling. I mean, and I work out.
Oh, I'd be worried they'd judge me, too.
Well,
yeah.
I think anybody thinks that. It's not that they're judging. It's they know what they're doing.
Yeah, they can just eye you up and know that you don't. Yeah.
Right. I mean, they have information. It's like if you meet a makeup artist or a hairstylist.
Yeah, I also don't like hanging out with them. Yeah.
Or even like a dentist, now that I think of it. But, you know, people know things, and I respect that.
Oh, totally.
I don't think Vinny would judge you.
I would be uncomfortable.
Anyway, you guys, Vinny is a super interesting guy, so go back and listen to that episode. But not today, because today I'm here with another super interesting person, Stephanie Mikus. And she brought forth the topic, I was the sick kid. You know, it's interesting, a lot of families grow up with like a sick kid. You know, like, or not necessarily a sick kid, but like a sick relative, or you know a sick kid in your neighborhood. You know,
that was me.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah. It's really, I'm so interested to talk to you because I don't think I've ever had the point of view of this particular person that you have in your neighborhood. You know,
thanks.
Like in my neighborhood, there was the one kid in the wheelchair, and then, you know, I mean, I'm just saying.
So
So we all have the thing.
Yeah, I was that kid.
Now my sister, she had meningitis, and she was sick for like 2 years, and she was kind of like the person in the back bedroom, you know, and it was really sad. It was hard. She had to miss school, and it can't be easy.
Yeah, no, it's really hard. I went to a private Catholic school. I missed a lot of school.
Yeah.
I was in the hospital a lot.
Did you miss a lot of church?
I tried to miss a lot of church, but we went almost every day at school, and then I was forced to go every Sunday.
Yeah, I was forced to go every Sunday, too.
I was also really religious until my first year of college.
Interesting. And then things, you just went off the rails, or?
I did. I think I chose to be religious because my life was really painful, and it didn't make a lot of sense why I would be suffering. And since I went to a Catholic school, it was so easily accessible that there was a plan and God would take care of me and I could, you know, talk to Jesus and Mary and feel comfort. And I found sanctuary in youth groups because I was such a...
You are so smart to see this now. Did you see it then or no?
No. Then right. it was just there and I was kind of forced into it. I was scared into it. I mean, Catholicism's like a lot.
Yeah,
so there wasn't really a choice. I kind of thought like you believed it or you went to hell.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it was the 90s. It wasn't like they were slapping us with rulers, but it was a lot of like,
guilt.
You need to like know that you're not worth anything without Jesus because like he died for you. So,
Yeah. It's a lot to deal with, right?
But when you're dying yourself, it's like kind of comforting to like picture Jesus on the cross and the idea of eternal life.
Sure. No, I don't think I can totally understand why people do organized religion, because there's a comfort there to know that like in an afterlife, you're going to see your dad again or your mom or whatever. And so people, that's their solace. And I sometimes wish I had that, because then, you know, it wouldn't be as, I don't know. I feel like there's beauty coming into the earth. Coming into the world, like, you know, I gave birth to my daughter, and I think there's also a beauty in the end of life. You know, I was with my dad when he passed.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, if it's not a sudden death or a tragic death or, you know, like you, a sick child. So so it's complicated.
Yeah, I became really spiritual after college. But in college, it was a slow progression. I mean, I just kind of learned more what was out there. I got into service work. I learned about how you could just be a good person without so many dogmatic rules. I started doing like getting politically active, and it kind of slowly transitioned.
And where did you grow up, and where did you go to school?
I grew up in Allentown, Pennsylvania, and I went to college in Scranton, Pennsylvania.
Wow, man, you went up to the big city.
Yeah.
That's funny. I'm from Pittsburgh, you know, and I know it's a very long state.
Yeah.
But I often forget about the middle part.
PA is a very interesting, it's a very interesting place.
Yeah? Do you think so?
I mean, it's like Midwestern, but it's not. It's like very trashy, but it's. But
it's Midwestern with a taste of Appalachia.
It's blue collar. It used to be pretty liberal, and it went red now, and it's like a little scary.
It just depends on where you are, obviously. Yeah. You know, like in Pittsburgh, there's all these fantastic universities and hospitals, and a whole like society of culture going on, and there's all sorts of theater and all sorts of concerts.
Well, Pittsburgh's
and stuff like
the
that.
Largest city in Pennsylvania, right?
And no, Philadelphia.
Is it really?
Philadelphia, yeah. Philadelphia is about three times the size of Philadelphia.
Oops,
Pittsburgh.
I lived in Philly for 5 years and I, oops.
I love Philadelphia.
That's great too.
Yeah, it's much more like New York, whereas Pittsburgh would be more toward Cleveland. You know, if we were doing a show today about, you know, about, you know, topography in the United States, we would be right on target.
We'd be killing it.
But that's not it. So listen, you guys, let's get right to Stephanie's story. Oh, wait, before we do that, I wanted to mention that congratulations on a film that you wrote, Stephanie, Hope Springs Eternal. You got some fantastic press on it.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah, I know. I got some good reviews. I feel very lucky.
And the movie, it just looks so slick. It's really slick. Hope Springs Eternal. And the trailer is really slick.
Thank you. Yeah.
Can I give a synopsis really quick to our audience?
Absolutely.
Just because this is a really catchy story, and it's unusual, yet it's simplistic in the same way, because you'd think, how didn't anybody come up with this before? So you did, Stephanie.
I did. Yeah. I did think that when
here's
I wrote it.
Here's this girl. Okay, so here's a girl in about, she's probably 13 years old, right? 13, 14?
I think they ended up making her 17.
No, really? And anyway, she has cancer, and she's dying. And so she gets a lot of support from everybody in her high school and her community, and she gets a boyfriend, and all these things start going right because she's made popular because she has this disease. Then the next thing you know, she's cured, and she doesn't have the disease anymore. But she doesn't really want to tell anybody because she's going to lose.
What a bitch, you know?
She's going to lose everything.
Yeah, she's really scared.
So she's in this place. It's really very interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely drew from my experience as a sick person. And there's just so many different angles that go through your mind that most people don't think about. But yeah, when I got better, I wanted to be sick again because it was all I knew and it was familiar. It's really hard to like. Any change is hard for adults, especially for children, and that's just such a big change. You don't know what to do. Like, you're the best thing ever has happened, and everyone else can see it, but you take a little longer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow, this is great. All right, so I'm so happy you're here. All right, you guys, Stephanie Mikus is a screenwriter, and like I said, her first feature film, Hope Springs Eternal, was just released a few weeks ago. You can find it on iTunes, and like you said, it's a coming-of-age dramedy about a young girl who's dying of cancer, but when she suddenly finds herself in remission, she conceals the news in an attempt to keep the status quo. You can find Stephanie over on Twitter. You're very popular on the Twitter, Stephanie.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, yeah, I put some time into it. You I do really, well, man. I really like, you know, making some jokes and insulting the patriarchy. It's
yeah, and your timeline is very clean. All your own stuff. You don't.
I do often, clean it up every night.
I think that's great.
I do.
Good on you, man.
Thank you.
You know, sometimes I just go off on like a oh my god fact or whatever. OMG facts.
Oh, I'll retweet like 10 stories about Trump and then I'll just delete them every night. I mean, I still go crazy. I just.
You're so
I
funny.
Clean it up. Yeah.
You clean it up. I hear what you're saying. It's just all it's all about the edit.
It is.
They say you write drunk, edit sober.
I say that. I'm a sober person in general. I haven't had alcohol in 5 years, but yeah. I still say that. Every time I sit down to write, I say that to myself.
You and Hemingway. You can find her over there on Twitter at Smickable. All right, you guys, wherever you are, put your hands together for Stephanie Mikus.
I grew up on the corner of 34th and Spruce in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. That was not the address of my childhood home, but rather the last light my mother would have to make a left at before we turned into Children's Hospital. It was at that red arrow that I learned how to be brave, how to prepare for the needles, the radioactive beverages, the pain that they thought needed a scale of smiley and frowny faces to explain, the blood, the smell, and the fear of disappointing my mother, my grandparents, and my sister, who must have felt like she was getting the raw end of the attention deal. In 1997, when I was 11, I was officially diagnosed with Crohn's disease. That's considered a pretty tender age to acquire an autoimmune disease, especially in an era where Full House and Caroline in the City were still on the air. And I, of course, had a very bad case. I don't say that to hyperbolize or even brag, but boy, did my immune system really like to attack my small intestines. You would have thought they were the next great matchup on the WWE Raw lineup, but in the 65-pound weight division. It felt like my body was truly at war, some part always trying to destroy another, and doctors and nurses desperately trying to figure out how to get ahead of the carnage. I became a very, how do I say this nicely, spirited and defiant child. My mother so kindly called me sensitive. But already at 12, I knew the truth. I could be a stone-cold bitch. I think I didn't like to be told what I was not so often. You're not healthy, you're sick. You're not normal, you're atypical. You aren't in puberty, you can't go to school, you can't eat pizza. In fact, you can't eat anything. Here's a tube to feed you instead. And also, we're just gonna sneak in and take like 3 feet of your guts. That cool? No. No was the word I said most often. I'd come around to almost every diagnostic tool, every treatment, every medicine, every surgery, most diets, eventually. But boy, did I want to assert my right to say no or no thank you since I was raised Catholic. An episode of ER I caught once made me worry if I had a thing called Munchausen's, which is a very German word for a mental disorder in which a patient physically makes themselves sick or stays sick in order to elicit attention from doctors, nurses, family, and friends. I wondered this because sometimes when it was too much, I'd pour my medicine down the bathroom drain. Sometimes when I was supposed to be fasting, I'd open the fridge door, slam a slice or two of leftover Mama Celeste pizza, wipe my face, and emerge with just that icy glass of water to which I was actually entitled. I would fire doctors. Not like ask my mom if they could never come back quietly later, but literally create performative theater where I bitingly uttered the phrase, "You're fired," which would be ruined by Donald Trump just a few years later. I'm so glad 11-year-old me didn't know how much he would ruin in my 30s. I think what took the cake, even for me, Stephanie, the dead-eyed princess, was the day I found out I had to get my first colonoscopy. That was a hard no for me. I knew this at 11. I wasn't a 50-year-old man, and God damn it, this wasn't happening. And how did I show my disdain and determination to avoid this test? I took a Sharpie and wrote the word no on every wall and every door of our entire upstairs childhood home. Then my single mother, God bless her, simply grounded me, sanded and painted over it, and then handed me a bill for materials and labor. That's how badly I wanted to protect my asshole. A trip to Home Depot and my first ever contractor bill. To this day, watching HGTV still makes me tighten up. But I don't think I ever had Munchausen's. I think I was just tired and very bad at being sick. Some people would say I was great at being sick. In fact, I'm probably the only 2001 Make-A-Wish kid who is still alive. Although in my hometown, it was off-brand and called Dream Come True. But I know I'm terrible at it. I absolutely hate it, and the only thing I kept doing was surviving. I used to beg for cancer, something with a definitive path, a treatment, a cure, hell, even just a death sentence. As a preteen suffering through enormous hell and being told you'll have this disease for the rest of your life is daunting to say the least, psychologically damaging more than likely. Something I would learn later in recovery, yes, I became a raging drug addict at some point in this journey, is the joke, how do you know an addict is almost ready to let go? You see the claw marks. And honestly, I think that's all it was. My tiny little pink claw marks from my first scratch and sniff manicure I gave myself. Sometimes this definitive and very adult realization that you just have to accept and act is a curse. In moments of weakness, I will still find myself being defiant. And as a woman and a comedy writer, I will use this to punish myself in endless loops. Still other times I'll see this flaw in other people or meet someone who's on the same journey as me but a few years behind. And I will not be able to help but try to jam that lesson down their throat. After college, I decided to volunteer at a camp for children with Crohn's and colitis. Not even 3 days into the summer, my PTSD was triggered by gaunt 13-year-olds who just wanted junk food, and I ran screaming out of my cabin. I conveniently faked a Crohn's flare and then exited the job. I was given a hand I didn't want to play. Sickness happened to me. I had no choice. And sickness changed my life a lot. My reality, my capabilities, others' perceptions of me, my perception of myself. And I hated that. But I was just a tad too young to know that one's only choice in a situation like that was to accept reality and operate with grace. I didn't make myself sick, and in 99% of ways, I didn't want to be sick, but I was just too young, too ill-equipped, and too confused to learn this lesson without making my journey with my illness just a little bit harder for a little bit longer. I eventually found a cocktail of the right meds and a few more surgeries. I even grew to the 120-pound weight class. I moved away to college, eventually to Philly, where I started comedy, and off to Los Angeles. My battle with Crohn's disease is far from over. In fact, I just spent a few weeks in Cedars-Sinai this past March, fasting and receiving IV steroids and nutrition. But when they asked me to chug that gallon of industrial-strength laxatives, you know what? I immediately put on some Demi Lovato and did it. Because I'm 31, and I know you have to play the hand you're dealt. And yes, to answer the one pressing question that still remains, I did anal a few times in my late 20s. Not as scary as I thought. But I did wake up the next morning and write no on the fog of the bathroom mirror for nostalgia.
Wow, Stephanie, that's such a funny ending. You're so funny.
Oh, thank you. It's the only thing I have.
That's a twist at the end. I didn't see that coming. Hey, so I'm not that familiar with Crohn's. What happens when you have an episode, as it were?
It's an autoimmune disease, so your body perceives other parts of your body as an enemy, like a foreign object. So with Crohn's, your immune system has a flaw and it starts attacking your stomach and your intestines, like really attacking them, like giving you ulcers and bleeding and inflammation and putting holes in it. And yeah.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
And so why would they want you to fast all the time? What's that all about?
There's like a double-handed way to deal with it. Especially when I was growing up, they didn't have really advanced drugs. They didn't have what they have now, which is immunosuppressants. Mm-hmm. Now you get IVs or shots and it shuts down your immune system, so it calms down. But back then, they basically just had pills you'd swallow and they would open up and kind of try to calm everything down. But things were so messy that it was really dangerous to eat. It was too dangerous to have like solid food because it could get caught or cause a perforation. So for a couple years, every night I'd go into like the family room and I'd watch reality TV and I had an hour to like put a feeding tube. I'd have to put it up my nose and down my throat. It was this little like snaky thing and I have to do that. And eventually I got super tired of that and I asked if they could just put a permanent one in.
Wow.
And they did.
That's intense.
Yeah.
Where's a permanent tube inserted?
I actually,
your stomach.
It's like right under your ribs.
Yeah.
It's just this little, like, the thing on a beach ball that you put air in. It's kind of like a little poppy out thing.
Unbelievable.
You can see your stomach. You can see. I took it out myself.
Wow.
Senior year.
Oh,
I locked
Stephanie.
My locked myself in my mom's bedroom.
Come
and
on.
I was like, I'm taking this out. And I just, like, breathed through it. And I took it. Yeah.
Some kids pierce their own ears. And you know what I mean? That's a big deal.
Yeah.
And then you're. So, do you have any brothers and sisters?
I have an older sister. She's 18 months older. She was a grade older.
So she's very close in age then.
And
so,
super healthy.
Oh, yeah.
Super healthy fucker.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. Did she help you out? I mean, or did she feel, what was she going through? That must have been tough.
I mean, we didn't really talk much growing up. She was a lot more mature than I was. She had a more formed personality. She was already, like, politically active. She knew who she was, and she had a lot of friends, and we didn't have much in common because I was really sick, and not that I was immature or juvenile, but I just was like a different temperature.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so now, like you said, you were just at Cedars in March.
Yeah.
What surgeries are they doing now? What are the surgeries?
The surgeries are still, you know, when it gets really bad, they'll cut some of your intestine out and then they'll sew it back together. But there's a lot of good stuff. My favorite procedure. I have a favorite procedure. That's,
yeah, this
so
is
weird.
Like, wow.
My favorite procedure is called a double balloon. They have a camera that they put you to sleep. They put a camera down your throat, but then the camera is encased in this thing that kind of looks like a Chinese finger trap, one of those water ones.
Yeah.
And it just kind of like goes through your intestines, really chill, and they stretch it out and they kind of like therapeutically like massage your intestines.
Amazing.
It's really great. I had one of them done in March. Super happy with
it. What do they call it?
The double balloon.
The double balloon.
Yeah.
I thought that was like a sex move.
It probably is too.
As well.
If you Google that right now, it probably is.
Have you ever been in love with a doctor? Have you ever dated a doctor?
Jesus. I have never dated one of my doctors. I always had very, very attractive, like, African or Middle Eastern, like, Egyptian, like, very attractive doctors. But they always, like, lacked, like, social skills. I think I had a crush on my first doctor and then maybe another one. But no, I mean, obviously, ethically, you don't date doctors.
No, but
I did
kind of like your savior in a way. I mean, because, you know, these guys are getting, you know, you've spent so much time with them. And you could tell that they're real people because you see, you know what I mean? So they're not like gods, like they're accessible because you know them now because you have to see them all the time.
Maybe I should, I'm saying, maybe I should fall in love with one of my doctors.
I swear to God, I just think it's so logical.
Although now, oddly, I only have like female, I'm going military. I only have female doctors now. I don't feel comfortable, but I dated a doctor.
Yeah.
And I did, he was interventional radiologist.
Oh.
Which is someone that literally does double balloons. Like, it's someone that instead of having.
And that's not the medical one either.
Instead of having surgery, they intervene with radiology. Mm. And I dated him in Philly. And I did enjoy the fact that he was very matter of fact, like, about bodily functions and about, he knew what Crohn's was like.
Yeah.
It was nice to have someone that kind of like, I've never dated someone who was sick. I always thought that would be the ultimate, like finding a man with Crohn's disease would be like the jackpot.
Did you always write, by the way? Because now, you know, you write all the time. When did you start writing?
Oh, wow. No, I did not always write. Even through high school, I was convinced I was a terrible writer. We basically only had to write, like, term papers, and my English teacher was so nice, I even wrote him into my movie, but I literally would have breakdowns, and I think, like, my sister and my mom wrote some papers for me. I didn't understand what a thesis statement was. I just got very freaked out, and it wasn't till after college when I found comedy, like, I found improv and sketch and stand-up that I actually started to write. I mean, obviously, I have a bachelor's degree. I wrote term papers.
Right.
But I thought I was a bad writer
There's such a difference between somebody telling you have to write a term paper on something specific and then coming up with your own material. I mean, that's two different kinds of writing.
That's very true. I mean, I think in Pennsylvania, it wasn't really, didn't seem like an option that you could write movies or TV. Yeah,
no, it didn't. It wasn't like a viable
thing. I'd never seen a script till like after college.
When I got to LA in 97, I remember going to a shop on Hollywood Boulevard, a bookstore, and they had scripts. And I'm like, oh my God, this is a script for television. Like, I had never held that in my hand. I'd never known that that's the way it is. Like, that's the format. And I was blown away. I mean, now, of course, with what they call the interweb, now everybody has access to everything.
But when I asked my mom, did I like comedy? Did I want to write? She's like, yeah, you like did stand-up bits about like Bill Clinton in like the foyer and made me watch. And like, she's like, you watched Rosie O'Donnell all the time. You watched news radio. I was like, did I?
Oh, that's pretty interesting.
I have no memory of this, but I did have a very big bond with television because I was so sick. And I liked the pacing, and I liked to be able to binge watch stuff. So I'd watch daytime TV when I was sick, and I think it was so comforting.
That's what I was thinking that maybe you wrote during a lot of that time. No. You were by yourself.
No,
watched TV.
No, I did. I watched TV.
Well, that probably, exactly. Like you said, it taught you the beats, and it taught you how to format the whole
idea
of a story.
Yeah, I didn't put it together. I had no idea that I wanted to be or could be a writer till, 2011. I randomly landed on a movie set, which was like Silver Linings Playbook that ended up winning an Oscar.
And what were you doing on that set?
Nannying for the producer.
No kidding.
Yeah. And I was like, what is this? Who are
these
people?
And so did you know he was a producer? Were you his nanny before or were you hired at that time?
No, there was an ad through an agency and I met with them and they didn't tell me what they did really. And then they hired me and then
wonderful.
I found out. Yeah.
And they said, we're going to need you on this set. It'll be for, was it like a 60-day shoot or how long was the shoot?
They only needed me for like 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But still, that's exciting.
It was my first time and everyone was like, oh, everyone assumed I wanted to be in the industry. They're like, when are you moving to LA? And I was like, I have no idea what you're talking about. Like, I had no... That was my first... In 2011? Like, that was my first... Yeah.
And then what? After that 2 weeks, you go back to Philadelphia.
This was in Philadelphia.
Oh,
shot
I see,
in Philly.
I see.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I was so, like, not LA. And then... and then stuff just started happening. I landed at a random improv show where I met like my best friend in comedy and I just started going to sketch shows and started looking at stand-up, started thinking maybe I could do it. And eventually, and he was really a really funny comedian, Aaron Herzog. He had just won like Philly's Funniest Person.
Mm-hmm.
And so you kind of have, they like kick you out at that point.
Yeah, you have to go to the next
so
level.
So he wanted to move and I was like,
that's exciting.
Do I want to move? So I sold like my car, sold all my stuff, bought a one-way ticket, a big suitcase, and told this producer, I was like, hey, I'm in LA if you need babysitting. And I like rented an apartment, faked a job to like get a car, lived in a hostel for a while.
Sure,
I was
sure,
like,
sure.
All of a sudden, I was like, this is the only thing I ever wanted to do. It was very
quick.
I'm
so happy. I tell you, we have a very similar story.
Yeah.
I mean, in terms of, and I got here when I was 31, actually.
Oh, wow.
And how old were you? You were 25?
Yeah, it was 6 years ago, yeah.
Yeah. And so, I love it. It's such a survivor story. It's beautiful. Now that you're here, did you have to find, like, all new doctors or whatever? Or do you have to, what you had as a child, do you have to carry this now forever, I guess?
I do. I moved here already having a doctor. My doctor, I'd been driving to the Cleveland Clinic from Philly, which was...
In Cleveland?
Yeah, I've been driving there. And one of the doctors there went to med school with a doctor at Cedars. And so I already knew that I could have that doctor.
That is so exciting. Yeah, that's so wonderful. So this is a great success story. I mean, I feel like the title of the story was I Was a Sick Kid, but it should be in parentheses, I was a sick kid and look at me now. You know what I mean? Like, really,
yeah, no,
it's exciting.
I mean, yeah, it is pretty, I have to stop myself and, because, we're like, I'm so hypercritical, I'm so anxious and, nervous, and it's really, I have to stop myself almost every day and verbally remind myself.
But really, that's every artist. You know what I mean? So you're not alone when you, I do that all the time as well. And you but we all do. So it's not like,
but yeah, it's pretty cool.
Take it for just, it's part of the way we live. There's always going to be a certain amount of uncertainty and a certain amount of not being confident, but be confident anyway. Does that
make sense? You my new life coach?
I think I might be. Oh my God, I'm connecting. There's like a...
I mean, we have the same haircut and the same hair color and the same
See?
Shirt.
It's
I
all
mean,
happening.
We should just do it.
You have on a Harley Davidson shirt.
I do.
And I have on a new one of my new Storyworthy shirts.
But
I finally got some Storyworthy shirts.
Did it come like cut off badass like that?
I cut off most of my
sleeves. I appreciate that style. That's my thing.
And my daughter also enjoys that now. And she has me cut off her sleeves. And I just do.
There's an art to it.
Yeah, there is. You have to follow the armhole, because if you don't, it's going to be all messed up and your bra straps are going to show. Hey, listen, I'm so happy to meet with you and to hear your wonderful, wonderful success story, really.
Thank you so much.
Just great. So follow Stephanie over there at Smickable. And while you're over there on Twitter, follow me too at Storyworthy. All right, you guys, I want to thank all the sponsors on the show today. And I really hope you guys check them out, because when you check out my sponsors, Stephanie, guess what happens?
You get money.
I get money. This is the transaction. And then I can keep going with Storyworthy.
Yeah.
Plus, I never, ever have any sponsors that I don't like, that I don't back.
That's good.
Yeah.
Because not everyone was using MailChimp.
No. I don't, you know what's funny about that is MailChimp is not one of my sponsors, and I use them.
For what?
For my newsletter.
Okay.
For my newsletter. Stephanie Mikus is going to join the Storyworthy mailing list, and you can too. Just head over to storyworthypodcast.com and join the mailing list. All right, you guys, I want to thank everybody over at Wondery Media, including Hernan Lopez, and everybody on the Wondery team. And one more time, thank you so much. On behalf of you, Stephanie Mikus, thank you so much for coming over and telling me your story. It's awesome.
Thank you.
My name is Christine Blackburn, saying make it a Storyworthy week.
Thanks for joining us on the Storyworthy Podcast. We'll be back next week with all new stories. Subscribe to Storyworthy on iTunes and visit the Storyworthy website at storyworthypodcast.com.